Okay, the first book of Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel, following through in your notes. In the Septuagint, it's 1 and 2 Kingdoms. In the Latin Vulgate, just Kings in the 1 and 2 Samuel. The principal characters, and this is one of those things you'll want to remember. Samuel, Saul, David. So principal characters in the first book of Samuel. G. Campbell Morgan, 1 Samuel, the transition. The first book of Samuel covers a period of transition in the history of the nation. Because they're going to go from what to what, class? From judges to kings. Okay. In this book, we have the history of the people from the last of the judges, the last judge, Samuel. Okay. Through the troublous times of Saul. In which people learn what government by man is really like. People learn what government by man is really like. To the beginning of the reign of the king chosen by God, David. Even Samuel represents a transition from seer to prophet. 1 Samuel 9:9. Interesting, a seer is one who sees. Okay? So, formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he spoke thus, "Come, let us go to the seer." And for he who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. Okay? And that was Samuel. What was the condition of the people at the end of Judges? Thumbs up and thumbs down. Thumbs down. They were in a terrible state of degeneracy. It was during this period that they had practiced but not ritually, rejected God from being their king. That was their practice, but that was not their ritual. They still went to church. The clamor for an earthly king was was the natural outcome of this practical rejection. Okay? Because that means they wanted to be like what? The nations around them, particularly the Philistines. The book naturally falls into three sections around the names of these three men, Samuel, Saul, and David. Chapters 1 through 7, pretty much about Saul, Samuel, and Saul, 8 through 15, David, 16 through 31. The periods of their influence overlap. There's some overlap in those. So Samuel 1 through 7, his preparation, 1 through 4, 1a. We have the crisis of the ark of the Philistines in 4, 1b through 7:1. Then we have Samuel as judge from 7:2 through verse 17 in chapter 7. His preparation. In the dark and troublesome times, the Lord is seen working toward deliverance. He works towards a lot of things, but he never seems to work fast enough for us. He's never like, by answering the prayer of faith in the heart of a simple and trusting woman, David. There was much of human passion manifested through desire. In barrenness, she turned to Jehovah as evidence of her trust in him. To realize that when you turn to God, you are demonstrating your trust. You went up to various groups. Through her evident faith, he prepared a way for the future guidance of the people. Through her boy Samuel, who is dedicated for life to the service of the Lord. Life in Shiloh, chapter 2, 12 to 36. There are two simultaneous threads in the story of life in Shiloh in the young days of Samuel and Israel. We have degeneration and regeneration. The degeneration and corruption of the priesthood was all of within the living boundaries of the tabernacle, Samuel was preserved from pollution. Okay? So don't tell me that all kids have to be raised in perfect environments in order to see the Lord. It's good. They were in a good environment. But that didn't always happen, does it? He grew up in the fear of the Lord in a very corrupt environment. Think about that. At last, while yet a boy, Samuel was distinctly called 3 times. The first message entrusted him was a terrible one. To deliver the message he had to his young lad, and it was regarding the high priest and his sons, and it was not good. During Samuel's period of growth, the Lord confirmed him by not permitting any word that he spoke to fail in fulfillment, which really made him a what? Prophet. Crisis of the Ark and the Philistines in 4:1b-7:1. In the midst of the disaster, hoping to save themselves, the men of Israel carried the Ark of God into the fight. It was an entirely superstitious use thereof and was utterly unavailable. The Philistines captured the Ark itself. Boy, I wonder who captured it. The Philistines have the Ark, 5:7:1. The history of their possession of it is most interesting one, to say the least. It reveals how when a people of God fail to bear witness for him, he becomes his own. He first lodged in the Dash God, in the house of the fish god, Dagon. He didn't do real well at all. With disastrous results to the idol. With speed and in fear, they carried it to Gath. They got rid of it. We're going to get rid of this, you know. And a plague fell upon the people. They moved it hastily to Ekron. These were all the cities of the Philistines. And painful and troublesome tumors broke out upon the people. At each move, the judgments became more severe. Philistia found out that she could conquer Israel. It was a different thing than dealing with Israel's tribe. And that would raise a good question. Why is it we're able to defeat these people but we can't defeat them? That's because these people are not ready. God will never be defeated, but we can. Listen, at last they decided to send the ark back. Wow, wisdom, huh? Accompanied by offerings which recognized that their plagues had been the visitation of God. Their offerings reflected their visitation of plagues upon them. Joshua of Beth Shemesh received the ark in a way worthy of an Israelite. A dark period of 20 years has now passed over without a detailed record. During that time, Israel was under Philistine rule without any definite center of worship. During this period, Samuel was advancing from youth to manhood in the hour of his leadership. This was ushered in by the lamenting of the people after God. That's a good thing, is it not? Amen. It is. Whatever it takes, right? Whatever it takes for your kids, whatever it takes for your loved ones, whatever it takes for their movement after God. Of this, he took advantage, calling them to return to him and put away all strange gods. They obeyed and were summoned to Mizpah. Here, by direct divine intervention, the power of Philistia was broken and her cities restored to them. Samuel erected an altar and called it Ebenezer, Rock of God. This man of clear vision recognized both the government of God and its beneficent method. The Lord had helped him through chastisement that led to sorrow for sin and through sorrow to freedom from oppression. Samuel as judge, this would be the third of our sections here, in a brief paragraph, the story of his actual judgeship is told. At Ramah was his home, and from there he journeyed in circuit once a year to Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah, thus maintaining oversight and administering the affairs of the people. Now, your first focus will be here regarding Samuel, the last of the judges. There's no more detail there. The Philistine threat, how long was that? Self-determination, people clamor for a king. So I'll let you read that. So that's how we got through that page. And most of this is supplemental to your reading in the book. Please read the book. Please read the book. It'll be somewhat different than what you but there will be some overlap. But repetition is the mother of all retention. So the more we hear it, the more we're going to retain it. Now, our second section is Saul. Okay, Samuel, Saul, who's the third person? David. Okay. This book now, in chapters 8 through 15, now merges into a second division, which has to do with Saul. His appointment as king in 8 through 10, his reign 11 through 14, his rejection in chapter 15. His appointment as king. The people clamored for a king. The occasion of their request was the maladministration of the sons of Samuel and their sinful practices. And God will use this, will he not, to ultimately establish his kingdom. And through him will come the king. He's about the son of Samuel. He's the son of Samuel. Oh, and, no, the son of Samuel. Oh, I'm sorry, you were. The son of Samuel who also lived in. But he did restrain him. He did, unlike Eli, he never restrained his son. He never stopped. But his sons had. Real principle underlying it was a desire on their part to be, as they said, like all the nations. They had been chosen to be unlike the nations, the people directly governed by Jehovah. Are we to be like the people around us? Because we were them. Samuel declared to them that what the issue of their wish would be if they were granted. He told them that everything that had happened, all the taxation that would occur, I can say that. Samuel was in every way a remarkable man. In the pursuit of his filial duty, he was led into contact with Samuel. While they were alone, Samuel, while they were alone, Samuel communicated to him his divine appointment. God appointed. This took place in this time. Here Saul manifested the first sign of weakness in character by hiding in his stuff. His hiding behind his stuff is often quoted as evidence of his modesty, which eventuated in his failure. Modesty, however, becomes sin when it prevents any man from stepping at once into God's call. It prevents you, your modesty, your fear, prevents you from doing what God's called you to do, then it is sin. And the caution is good. The caution that prevents you from doing the will of God is sin. And that was one of the devil's most major reasons. His reign, 11 through 14, Saul did not take up the responsibilities of king right away. Instead, he returned home to Gibeah until stirred to action by the Ammonite. It's like he felt like he had to wait until something was going on before he started being king. He gained a complete victory over them. Samuel immediately gathered the people who lived down, and Saul was confirmed in the kingship. On that occasion, Samuel delivered what was practically his last great address to the nation. Samuel understood that these people could only be great because they remained loyal to the throne of God, not just the throne of man. Two chapters give an account of the war Saul waged. It was in the midst of the fear which possessed the Israelites that Saul manifested his self-independence. He, by offering sacrifices in the absence and without the instruction of Samuel. The king's deterioration of character is manifest in the fact that he remained idle in Gibeah with his army instead of fighting the Philistines. Here he is again. He's being reticent after the battle. It was at this time that Jonathan made the great strategic attack upon the Philistines, which resulted in their rout. Saul was commissioned by the Lord to Samuel to smite and destroy Ammon. In connection with that campaign, heard the sin which filled his cup to the brim, and he was rejected and caused him to be rejected. His rejection, chapter 15. While he was victorious, he was disobedient in that he spared Agag and part of the spoil. Samuel and Saul are seen in striking contrast at this point. Saul, a man of great opportunity, miserably failing, passing along the pathway of disobedience to the Lord. While he failed, Samuel denounced him without sparing, and then in loneliness he mourned. He loved Saul. And yet he also was faithful to God in the death of him. So your focus will be on more in depth information about Saul, the first of the kings. So I'll leave that to you to read and study that. Then we come to the third person, who is? David, chapter 16 through 31. We now come to the third section of the book, which David is the principal figure. So his preparation, chapters 16 through 20. On the run in exile, 21 through 27. Returning to a tragic end, 28 through 31. Preparation. Samuel was rebuked for prolonged mourning and was commissioned to arise and to anoint the new king. Through the spiritual melancholy of Saul, David found his way to the court as his soul soothed the rebellion of his heart. That's where he learned the court and how to run the court, or how not to run the court, perhaps. Having a spirit reside, I'm not sure is good. Then immediately the two men are seen in the presence of a national danger. Saul, notwithstanding his position in his army, was utterly incompetent. And David, without human resource, but conscious of the true greatness of his people, and sure of the strength of God, gained his victory over Goliath. Thus it gave also the victory over the Philistine. One of the most charming love stories of the Bible is that of friendship between Jonathan and David. Coincident with the commencement thereof, the hatred of Saul against David deep and manifested itself in deeply laid schemes and unworthy methods in which he attempted to rid himself of his rival. These were the trying days for the young man anointed to the kingly office, and it was natural that he should flee to Samuel for protection. Saul fast became an irresponsible madman, while David, through all the painful discipline, was being prepared for the work that lay before him. Then he's on the run in exile, 21 through 27. At last, the land itself seemed too hot to open, and he took refuge in the plain. The period of his exile was characterized by varying experiences. Once he found refuge at Achish among the Philistines, and there had to feign madness. Coming at last to Ephraim, he gathered around him a band of the outcasts of his own people. During this period, Samuel died. Twice the life of Saul was in David's hand, and on each occasion he spared it. I will not touch the Lord's hand. So terrible was the pressure of these dark days that David himself became pessimistic. He said in his heart, I shall not perish one day by the hand of Saul. You know, after many years, I intend to forget the calling of God, that he will make it happen. And he was, by some accounts, as much as 17 to 20 years being chased by Saul. That is a long time, especially when you are going to be king at the beginning. Returning to a tragic end, 28:31. Perhaps there's no chapter in Old Testament history more tragic than that of Saul's end. The last manifestation of his degradation was that of his visit to the witch of Endor. The men of Philistia became afraid of David, and he was dismissed from their midst. He returned to Ziklag and found that it had been sacked by the Amalekites. Closing chapter of the book is draped in sackcloth and ashes. It tells the story of the end of the career of one of the most disastrous failures. Saul died upon the field of battle by his own hand. The chief spiritual value of this whole book lies in the solemn lessons it teaches by the life and failure and death of Saul. So I hope, we all hope, that he has done some good in death that he did not. Furthermore, his story proclaims the fact that great advantages and remarkable opportunities are no guarantees of success. Unless the heart be firm and steady in its allegiance to the principle, and its loyalty to God. Focus. The focus will be you have here is on Goliath. Very interesting man, definitely, if you will. The second book of Samuel, Morgan, 2 Samuel, Theocratic Monarchy. This book deals almost exclusively with the history of David. Not with the whole of it, for it begins in 1 Samuel, as we saw, runs on into 1 Kings. Plus, he's dealt with from another standpoint in 1 Chronicles. It is, however, the principal history of his kingship. Second book of Samuel, you'll want to, in your memory banks, say that's primarily I'm going to learn about who? David. Okay. The people had clamored for a king. God gave them one after their own heart, and I added here, after the order of the Philistine. His spear was Philistine-esque. His armor was like the Philistine, was like scales. Goliath came at David with his spear. He had a sword, but he was a king of the order of the Philistines. He was tall. He was a big man, like the Philistine. He then gave them one after his own heart. That would be David. Saul's preparation, you notice, was a lot different than David's. Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. Those were the fiercest warriors in Israel. And if I was to pick a king to defeat the military, I'd go with the fiercest tribe of all. That would be Benjamin. And they did. And he was head and shoulders taller than everybody else. So he was a king after the mold of the Philistia and of the people's desire. So there are three main divisions here. David's rise, 1 through 9, David's fall, 11 through 20, and then there's an illustrative appendix of various accounts in 21 through 24. David's rise. In this first division of the book, there are two movements. One dealing with David's reign over Judah. He reigned over Judah for 7 years. The second, with his reign over the whole nation from Jerusalem for 33 years. So he reigned for 4 years. David's reign over Judah at Hebron, which is in Judah, chapters 1 through 4. We open with the Amalekite bringing news of his killing Saul, thinking David would be pleased, because all the years that Saul tried to kill him. The story was evidently a fabrication, but David dealt with him severely. Then sang his greatest stately and dignified lamentation over the death of Saul and Jonathan, who were both slain. Anointed king of Judah, David's first act was that of inquiring God as to what he should do. The spirit of Saul, which was that of antagonism to David, was perpetuated in Abner, his general, his primary military leader. Abner set out to consolidate the kingdom of Israel around the house of Saul. David's general, Joab, a strange, rugged, fierce, and faithful, and very loyal man to David. The struggle was a long and weary one, especially between Abner and Joab. Abner's trying to reestablish the house of Saul. Joab is fighting to grow the house of David. But as the chronicler declares, David waxed stronger and stronger, but the house of Saul waned. Now David then reigns over all of Israel in chapters 5 through 10. David had won the heart of all Israel by his consistent justice. The people recognized the kingly qualities of the man. And he was at last crowned king of the whole nation in chapter 5. His first victory was that of taking of Jebus, which is Jerusalem, in 1 Chronicles 11, 4. It's interesting name, Jerusalem, Jebus. There's a story behind that, but I'll read into it. A pattern of weakness manifested itself at this point in David's life. Then on the consolidated throne, he multiplied his concubines and wives. Victorious in war, the king was not unmindful of the central truth of that national life over which he was called to reside. He brought the ark into the capital, chapter 7 and 8, followed closely in his great desire to build the temple. He appealed to Nathan, who advised him to do all that was in his heart. It was not, however, in the will of God that he should carry out this work. Nathan was sent back to deliver the bad news, which affected them both. Both Nathan and David were ready to submit to the declaration of the will of God. The house of the Lord was still in his mind, in David's mind. By his many victories, he not only strengthened his position, but gathered temple-building treasure. He was yet gathering in preparation for the work of his son. The king's love for Jonathan was still fresh. There is an exquisite tenderness about the story of David and Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth. For David, the house of Saul, which had done him so much harm, was redeemed by his love for Jonathan. David's inquiry as to whether Jonathan had any seed alive to whom he might show kindness. This inquiry was rewarded by the finding of Mephibosheth, who was lame of foot. To him the king restored the lands of Saul and sent him as an honored guest at his home table. The record proceeds to give an account of victories gained over Ammon and Syria, who were all neighbors in chapter 10. These victories and how they were won constitutes the culmination of David's rise to power. Then he prepares for the terrible story of his fall, showing us the general circumstances under which that fall had occurred. Focus. So there's a focus here, a lot of focus about David, some details about David who set up as king, the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel 7, which is the reiteration of the Davidic covenant, the Apostolic covenant, and the perpetuity of someone sitting from his seed, his throne forever. Page 9. That's some key points. The scarlet thread continues. He started the scarlet thread with who? Eve and the serpent. So that scarlet thread continues. David's zenith. The zenith of his power and confirmation of the land. Then we come to David's fall. That's part of his book. Chapter 11 and 20. His sins and repentance. Chapter 11 through 12. Punishment. Chapter 13 through 18. sins and repentance, 11 through 12. In all the Bible, there's no chapter more tragic, solemn, and searching, warning us through the tragedy and the story of David's fall. Carefully pondering it, we notice the logical steps downward following in rapid succession. First, David tarried at Jerusalem. But he never wanted to retire. It was the time of war, and his place was with his men. But he remained behind in an idle atmosphere of temptation. An idle atmosphere. In briefest quotations, we may indicate the downward movement. He saw, he sent, and inquired. The king has fallen to that inner weakness which has already been manifest prior to this. His sin against Uriah, one of the bravest of the soldiers, was even more dastardly than that against his wife. From the merely human standpoint, the unutterable folly of the whole thing is evident. In a year, the prophet David visited him and charged him with his sin. One can almost imagine that after the year of untold misery, this visit of Nathan came as a relief to the guilty man. And if you want to see the misery in this year,
read Psalm 32 and Psalm 15. Both about this. His repentance was genuine and immediate after Nathan's confrontation. Didn't need to go away and think about it, rationalize it. It was genuine, it was immediate. The punishment, chapters 13 through 8. Those in leadership, those who represent God and people, receive greater condemnation, receive greater judgment. The sincerity of David's repentance was manifest in his attitude toward his manifold punishment. When the child died, David worshiped. The sin of Amnon afflicted him grievously, because it was after the pattern of his own weakness that he took his half-sister. Perhaps the severest suffering of all came to him through the rebellion of Absalom, his son. The heartlessness and cruelty of Absalom fell like an avalanche of pain. It is a question whether he suffered more in the day of Absalom's short-lived victory over him, or in the dark and dreadful hour of his defeat and slaying of Absalom. His lament over Absalom is a perfect revelation of grief. At last, the rebellion being quelled, the king was brought back to the kingdom, and there was a reconstruction. New officers were appointed in the different departments of state. And so what we saw when we spoke about this, Nathan told them, the sword would not be used. They came down hard and heavy. Focusing. So you have David's turning point regarding his great sin, years of suffering, troubles in the family. And then our third section, I'll let you focus on the illustrating index, the government of God and the character of David. We have some looking back on some significant incidents that demonstrate the government of God and the character of David. And so that will take us, and we had the heroic men of David are included in that appendix. The book closes with one other picture. And then we have the threshing floor. The book ends with the story of the erection of the altar in the threshing floor of Arunah and Jebusite. To that we see finally the man after God's own heart turning the occasion of sins and punishment into one of worship that's applied on page 11. So that page 11 in the previous paragraph you read and study on your own. Then we come to 1 Kings. Discontinuance through disobedience. In Septuagint, first, second Kings, third and fourth kingdoms, in the Latin Vulgate, just kingdoms. David's 40-year reign, Solomon, the Davidic kingdom, the exile, Assyria, and Babylon. In the Septuagint, these books are called First, Second, Third, and Fourth Kingdom. We've already stated that, and what they're called in Latin order. Morgan, First Kings, Disruption. The two books of Kings appear in the Hebrew Bible as one. They practically cover the whole period of kingly rule over the ancient people. In the reign of Solomon, the kingdom reached the height of its material and military magnificence. With his passing, the kingship really ceased to be the medium of the divine government with his passing. Instead, the prophetic period was introduced with the appearance of Elijah. First Kings may be divided thus, the passing of David. And the passing that we're talking about is David. Okay? So, with the fall, the kings that followed, it was necessary. They did not, Solomon later in his life, did not follow the Lord. And those that followed him often did not as well. The majority did not. And so what God brought onto the scene were prophets who brought his voice into their lives. He brought his voice into their lives. So Elijah here would be the first. And the passing of David is very short. It's chapter 1 to 2. We have a Solomon,
2 and 12 through 11, we have vision, chapters 12 through 16, and Elijah 17 through 22, passing of David, the days of David's feebleness created opportunity for rebellion against him under Adonijah. Joab and Abiathar, the high priest, took part in this rebellion. In consequence of this rebellion, Solomon was crowned before the passing of David. Very few. The action of Solomon towards Adonijah was characteristic of the best side of his nature. It was one in which clemency and dignified authority were commended. The last charge of David was one in which he indicated the path of safety for Solomon. It was that of absolute loyalty to God. And Solomon started out that way. That part of it in which David referred to Joab and Shimei has been very seriously criticized. Much of this criticism would be impossible with some very simple things were borne in mind. First, David knew these men by experience appreciated their danger to the state to Solomon. Second, he had kept his covenant with them and spared their lives. He had David. Third, in each case, he left the matter of how to deal with them in the hands of wise Solomon, and he dealt with them very wisely. Finally, his words concerning the death of each are prophetic rather than vindictive. Solomon, chapter 2, 12 through chapter 11, 40 years, the reign of Solomon for 40 years. Ascension, the temple was built, the zenith of fame and glory, decline and deceit. This division falls into two parts. First, that which reveals Solomon in all his glory. Second, that which tells of the passing of that glory, the fading away of that glory. Among the first acts of the new king, he dealt with the leading men of the kingdom who held to treacherous impulses, and we just read about that. There was no vindictive vengeance. There was no vacillating weakness. Early in his reign, Jehovah appeared to Solomon in a dream. With that appearance came Solomon's great opportunity. He chose great wisdom from God. It revealed his consciousness of personal inability for all the work placed upon him. By his asking for wisdom, showed that he realized how weak and how unable he was. And that's always a good place to start. God gave him what he asked, added the things he might also have chosen beside him. The account of his choice is followed by a picture where he is seen exercising the gift of wisdom that he had asked, in which God had granted to him. That was a picture of the baby whose mother was. He gave himself to a careful organization of his kingdom, gathering around him a company of officers of state. These were the days of the nation's greatest material prosperity. The people lived in merriment and dwelt safely beneath their own vines and fig trees. The temple. Solomon then turned his attention to building the temple. The greatness of the work may be gathered from the account of the enormous labor employed. Like the tabernacle of old, its chief splendor was within. The tabernacle, remember, was most beautiful from the outside or the inside?
Inside.
And that's how we live. Everything was encased in gold, neither wood nor stone being visible. With great care and impressive ceremony, they carried the ark into the holy holies. The glory of the Lord filled the house just as he did the tabernacle in the wilderness. The king offered the dedicatory prayer standing by the altar of burnt offering. At the close of ceremonies, the joyful people returned to their tents. The temple was erected, and the presence of God was visibly manifested. The Lord now appeared to Solomon for the second time, declaring to him that his prayer was heard in answer, reminding him of the conditions which the people must fulfill, remaining loyal to him by keeping the law. The material magnificence of the kingdom is marred by a mixture of failure. Here were some of the failures. Cities were presented to Hiram of Lebanon, who supplied a lot of wood to David.
But he was dissatisfied with it. Cities were built within the kingdom by him, but they became hotbeds of evil. And commerce with other lands was established, but it became the medium of bringing into the land things which affected evil. So they brought with them these crazy their adultery, their practices, their sins. And sin is often copied, isn't it? The coming of the Queen of Sheba reveals how far the fame of Solomon had spread abroad. An account of the king's wealth cannot be read without the consciousness that that the weaker, the baser nature is manifested in the abounding luxury with which he surrounded himself. Suddenly the glory passed away. In the rapid movements we behold his degeneracy and doom. His alliance with commercial enterprises led him into contact with surrounding people. He gave himself over to Oriental customs. He allowed his heart to go after strange women and their god. The wrong thus begun invaded higher realms. He built temples for the strange women who crowded his harem. Gradually there followed the demoralization of both of the king and of his people. Then at last the terrible words were written in chapter 11, verse 9. The Lord is angry, he is solemn. The judgment of God began to operate immediately, and adversaries were raised up against him in response to the seductions of his own sensual nature. Now your focus will be on Solomon, the temple, 183,000 workforce. And then you have there a little drawing, a little template of the temple. You know, it's interesting, in the New Testament, we call them the temple. We don't call them the tabernacle. We call them the temple. So there's a relationship there. And it's no longer Solomon, the man of peace, built the temple. And he is a ubiquitous leader, he's Jesus Christ. Us. So you have there a great picture of the little temple and how it could relate to us individually and collectively as a church. And you have some other things about the temple we won't see, more about Solomon and Zenith of his kingdom, his failure. And then you come to the end of your focus, the kingdom being ripped with disobedience. Following the death of Solomon, an appalling story of the breakup and degradation of the people, covering a period of about 60 years. The kingdom was torn in two. Rehoboam's sin cursed the whole history of the people. The judgment of God proceeded immediately. Its first stroke was that of the sickness of Jeroboam's son. The prophet Ahijah uttered the doom of man and all that was his. The great sin of Jeroboam was what? The setting up calf worship so that the people in Mark would not need or want to go to Jerusalem, not feast it, and fire the everything was down the hill. There were no new kings in the land. In the meantime, Judah was also sinning. Thus, so quickly after David, the nation was steeped in idolatry. And Judah, under Abijah, the process of deterioration went forward. And corruption was not universal, though. God maintained his land in the midst of his people. With the ascension and long reign of Asa, there was a halt in the downward progress. So we had these slides in Judah, then there would be tapering off. And then the slides and tapering off. In the north, it was just one free fall. In the history of Israel, the government of God can be traced, proceeding in a series of judgments against the continuing sin of successive kings. Now, your
your kingdom, you'll have a narrative there. Then the divided kingdom, Jeroboam's falling. So you're going to have more information about that there. Then we turn to Elijah, the last section of this particular book, on page 17. With the appearance of Elijah, the voice of the prophet was raised to that of national importance. And he was a prophet where? North or south?
North.
North. In the north. Okay. God still had a voice in the north. Okay. From this point onward, the divine government, in the divine government, the prophet was superior to the king. Elijah appeared with startling and dramatic sentiments. Without apology, he declared himself the messenger of Jehovah. At his word, judgment fell upon the people. So who does he sound like in the New Testament?
John the Baptist.
John the Baptist, suddenly, just on the scene, and with a strong voice. At Carmel, the story of trial by fire in Carmel is full of majesty and needs no real comment. The lonely figure of Elijah is the center of observation. The calm dignity stood against the combined evils of a corrupt court and priesthood. His vindication by the answering fire of God was perfect. The slaughter of the prophets of Baal aroused the ire of Jezebel. She sent a message full of fury to Elijah. Elijah's discouragement. The man who stood erect in the presence of such tremendous odds now was very discouraged. I have failed, and the people have not turned. The people did not turn. They said they would, but they did not turn. And he took the blame for that. And he said, I'm no better than my fathers. No better than my fathers. I have failed. He went to Horeb in the south, deep south, to report his failure, thinking that he alone was left to serve the Lord in the north, in the northern kingdom. Full of tenderness was the method of God with his overwrought servant. Attending first to his physical needs, he then granted him a revelation of himself. It was a new revelation by which Elijah found that God was in the sound of gentle stillness. From this time forward, only once or twice does he appear to him in the narrative. And your focus here is going to be on Ahab, the most wicked king of the north. And then more focus on the prophet Elijah at the bottom of 17. Then you're going to focus on Queen Jezebel, Ahab's queen. What a wicked woman she was. And there's a further focus on the conversation on Mount Carmel. The second book of Kings. Second Kings, corruption. Second Kings contains the most tragic national record ever written. The first book of Kings ended with the dark days immediately following the death of Ahab and the passing into comparative obscurity of Elijah. This book centers first around Elisha. Their course from corruption to captivity is then traced in sections alternating between Israel and Judah. They both were on a course of corruption. The difference being in Judah, there was some stopping of it for periods of time, and then a restarting of corruption of evil. And it was all dependent on the king. Think about yourself as one person. How one person can stop it. So think about that. Think about your intercession for your family, for whatever is going on in destruction. Think about that one person, you and that person. Conspicuous breaks of light are seen in their history are caused by the reigns of Hezekiah and Josiah, two particular beacons of light in the history of Judah. We may divide the book into four sections. Elisha, 1 to 9, corruption, 10 to 17, Hezekiah and Josiah, 18 to 23, 30, captivity, 23, 31 through 25. Elisha 1 through 9. The book opens with the story of the sin and sickness of Ahaziah. He sought counsel from Baal Zebub,
What does that sound like?
Yeah. The god of Ekron, he's one of the cities of the Philistines on the coast. Elijah, who had been in seclusion, suddenly appeared, protested against the action of the king. In each case, the answer of God on behalf of the servant was the swift judgment of fire. Transition to Elisha. There's something pathetic and almost weird in the last stories of Elijah. Elisha, upon whom his mantle had already been cast, followed him loyally, determined to stand by him. Having witnessed his translation, he at once commenced his own ministry. Notice how different these two men are. Okay? Two incidents are recorded, one beneficial, the healing of the waters, the other punitive, the destruction of the taunting young adults. The last is misinterpreted, looked upon as an act of personal vengeance. It is rather an evidence of the sacredness of his office and of the sin of refusing him as the messenger of God. Elisha, the ministry of Elisha stands in many respects in vivid contrast to that of Elisha. So John the Baptist ministered at the same time as the one who was 6 months younger than him. Who is that? So when you think of Elijah, you think of John the Baptist. When you think of Elisha, who do you think of? Jesus. You see that. Ministry of Elisha, let's see. There is a gentleness about it which, in spite of ourselves, reminds us of the Messiah. Instead of suddenly appearing at critical moments with thunder and a flame, he seems to have moved about amongst the people, doing good wherever he came. He made provision for the need of the widow whose creditors were threatened. He showed kindness to the Shunammite woman who had shown him hospitality. At Gilgal, he purified the pottage and fed a 100 men with 20 loaves. During all this time, he was at the head of the prophetic school as their teacher, journeying from place to place and became known everywhere as the messenger of God. Now, who does that sound like? Sounds a lot like Jesus. His life. The simplicity of his life is suggested by the provision which the Shunammite woman, wealthy though she was, made for his evident requirements. His apartment was a little chamber on the wall containing a bed and a table, a stool, and a candlestick. Pretty neat, right? Jesus said, "Foxes have holes, birds in the air have nests, and everybody in the air." So you see a little bit of comparison. His dignity is manifest in the attitude toward him. This woman, who in her conversations with him, stood ever respectful in his office. She stood in the doorway. The account of the healing of Naaman reveals Elisha's perpetual attitude of dignified humility to God. What a great story that is. Jesus quotes that in the gospel. Your focus will be further on Elisha as a prophet. Okay? And then Elisha, more of Elisha, and then the corruption in chapters 10 through 17 in the kingdom. You're going to focus on that. You're going to be looking back then again to Judah. Remember, you're going to go back and forth between, here in 17, between Israel and Judah. Okay? Then you have ascension by murder in the north. One king murdered by another, the succession was the way you ascended to the throne is you murdered the man ahead of you, even if he was family. And so it's ascension to the throne. This is in the north. Turning to Israel, we have the chronicle of the period of the most terrible in its history. You're going to be reading that. And then we go back to Judah. Israel taken captive. And Israel, Hoshea, was the last of the kings. Finally, we come to the end. And the stroke of divine judgment, long hanging over the guilty people, fell. The Assyrian, Shalmaneser, made them tributary. And after 3 years, he carried them away captive. So he's the Assyrian. So then we move to page 21. Hezekiah and Josiah. So we're back to where? Back to the south, back to Judah. The vision of the book includes the story of the reigns of Hezekiah and the third division in Josiah, the period of reaction and sin between the two kings. Hezekiah did right inside the Lord. He instituted reforms more widespread and drastic than had been attempted by any of his predecessors. It was during his reign in the sixth year that Israel was carried away into captivity. So while during his reign, when reforms were going on, the north was taken away by the Assyrians. Okay. This in itself would have a righteous influence upon Judah, but for a time at least. The prophets would carefully point out the real reason of this northern judgment. Sennacherib and Hezekiah, when he had occupied the throne for 14 years, a most formidable foe appeared at his doorstep, the Assyrian king Sennacherib. In the hour of peril, he turned to his old and trusted friend, Isaiah, and charged him to pray for that remnant of God's people would still remain. He also foretold the judgment which would fall upon Assyria, which prophecy was fulfilled in the destruction of 185,000 of his army as they were coming down to attack Judah. Sennacherib escaped to Nineveh only to be slain at the house of his own God. Okay. The last things in the life of Hezekiah were manifestations of his weakness, yet his reign was in many respects a most remarkable one. Manasseh and Ammon. Then comes the account of opposite reaction to Hezekiah, which was manifest in two reigns, both utterly evil. That of Manasseh lasting for 55 years, that of Ammon lasting for 2. Get the impression that the dads here do not fasten upon the baby in their life and the baby and with their dads. Get the impression that it's like they're getting rid of all of the things that God is doing. He came to do it. God help us as fathers. Also, Manasseh's sin was not merely one of personal wrongdoing, but also the deliberate undoing of what his father had been at such pains to accomplish. After a brief reign of 2 years, Ammon, who succeeded Manasseh, was slain by his servant. Josiah, with the ascension of Josiah, there came the last attempt at reformation before the final sweeping away into the captivity to Babylon. His first act was that of the restoration of the temple. In connection with it came the discovery of the book of the law. You imagine knowing that the book of the law. It was hidden and covered with dust, buried somewhere. The condition of affairs in Judah may be gathered from the fact of such a finding. So sadly was the temple neglected and deserted that it would seem as though neither king nor priest knew of the whereabouts of this book. The Reformation proceeded along deeper lines as a result of its discovery. So far as Josiah was concerned, the whole procedure was the outcome of sincerity and loyalty. But the people, however, would not follow the lead of the king. Yet because of this one man, there was peace in Judah, though the people did not follow his lead. They remained in idolatrous, evil sin. There was no turning on their part to God. Consequently, there was no turning in the part of God from his purpose of judgment. It was only stayed during the reign of Josiah. He was killed in battle. Josiah was gathered to rest before the falling of the final stroke into captivity. Chapters 31 through chapter 25. The judgments fell at last in rapid succession. Jehoiakim succeeded to the throne. Notwithstanding all that had been done during the reign of Josiah, he turned immediately to evil courses in his brief reign of 3 months. In 3 months, they had returned. The kingship and all his house leaders had returned to evil. He was disposed of by the king of Egypt. Jehoiakim was set upon the throne as tributary to Pharaoh. For 11 years, as the vassal of Egypt, he continued in evil courses, Babylon. He then became tributary to Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. Finally, Jehoiachin succeeded Jehoiakim. You got to keep those straight with me. Test. He was carried away by Nebuchadnezzar. In his place, Zedekiah was made ruler as a representative and vassal of Nebuchadnezzar. His occupancy of the position lasted for 11 years, during which he also continued in evil courses. In the process of time, he rebelled against the kingdom of Babylon and was captured. The picture of this man is tragic and awful. With his eyes put out and bound in fetters or irons, he was carried to the court of the conqueror, the type and symbol of the condition of people who had rebelled against God. He symbolized and looked like people. They had been broken in captivity. Thus, on the human side, the record ends in tragic and disastrous failure. Those whose eyes are fixed upon the eternal throne, the divine purpose must be accomplished. The people have passed 70 long years of servitude and suffering, during which they were still watched over by their one and only king. By these very conditions, prepared for cooperation in the future, the 70 years of servitude prepared them for the future to come back into the land. Focus. You're focusing on the two kingdoms again, the Davidic dynasty. Object lessons ignored. The history of man teaches us that man learns nothing from history. Boy, amen to that. Okay, so your next page continues your, what you're going to focus on, the price of compromise and the 10 lost tribes. Used to be a big deal some years back. Not so much today, but it's good for you to know what happened to those 10 tribes. And then we come to 1 Chronicles, the house of the Lord. Morgan, 1 Chronicles, the temple, desire, and approach. The two books of Chronicles cover the period of history already studied in 1 and 2 Kings. 1 Chronicles, the temple, desire, and approach. They record this history, however, from an entirely different standpoint than 1 and 2 Kings. The outlook is almost exclusively confined to Judah. The chronicler never referring to Israel the north except in cases of absolute necessity. Within the tribe of Judah, moreover, the history is that of the house of David, all other matters being referred to only as they affect or are affected by the Davidic one. The temple. Moreover, the story of these two books centers around the temple. So, Chronicles. You think of 1 and 2 Chronicles, you're going to think of two things. David and Judah, and the temple. Okay? That's what you're going to think of. The chief matter of David's reign is his interest in preparing for it, the temple. In regards to Solomon, the chief interest is in building it. That's the focus in Chronicles. The distinctive note of the books is that of spirituality and its bearing on the national life. In the first, certain genealogies are given, which lead up to David and proceed from him. Then the story of his time is told in its relation preeminently to spiritual life. It has been truly said that while the king described the history from the prophetic standpoint, Chronicles describes it from the priestly, the temple. Okay. The book may be divided into two parts, genealogies, 1-9, and David. So your focus will be on the genealogies, and there's some interesting stuff from there. Israel's main genealogies, 1-9. Page 24, in your focus, you will read on your own. From Adam to Nehemiah, the genealogy goes from Adam to Nehemiah, then from Adam to David to captivity. And there are observations about the genealogies that we have for you. We have the Levitical priesthood. Now, Saul, this division ends with the story of the death of the king chosen by men at the end of 1 Chronicles. And what we need to know, and you're going to do some focus on this, on page 25 at the top, Saul was set up to succeed.
He had the calling. He had the Spirit of God. He was not set up to fail. And so then we
look at David in chapters 10 through 29. David's reign in Jerusalem. In this division of the book, there are four movements: anointed of the Lord, the ark of the Lord, the covenant of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. The story of David's crowning events are connected with the ark of God. The account of his reign and matters concerning the building of the temple. See, the focus here is on spiritual things, art, the temple, of gathering the materials for the temple. The chronicler passes over 7 years in which David reigned over Judah. Doesn't even talk about it, okay? Because it has nothing to do with what? The ark or the temple, okay? See, the focus here is different than 1 and 2 Kings. And commences with the crowning at Hebron over all Israel. Maybe after he had been recognized as king of the whole nation, he captured Jebus, which is Jerusalem, which became the city of his heart and metropolis of the nation. And your focus then, as you continue, there's a focus on David's mighty men, David and the ark. A lot there about David and the ark. The next section, your focus, you're going to focus on page 26, tells the story of David's reign. From a chronicle's point of view, David numbers the people. Okay, that's a sin that he committed. You need to read about that and find out what happened there. David and temple worship. His interest in the temple went beyond just supplying the materials to build it. He also set up the worship because he is the primary writer of what book that has 150 songs. He sets up the worship and that before the temple is even built. How cool is that? Then we have the last things of David that you are going to focus on page 27, and then David's death. So you have a long focus section here. Second Chronicles, the temple versus the throne. Okay. Morgan, Second Chronicles, the temple possessed and abandoned. This is really the second half of the one book of Chronicles. The essential values are the same as those in First Chronicles. The history surrenders around the religious life of the people. Okay? And that makes it a different emphasis in First and Second Kings. Confined to Judah and the Davidic line of kings is the focus of Chronicles. Degeneracy resulted from neglect of the house of God and its true spiritual life. Each reform was associated with return to its life and centrality. The story is a very sad one, opening with all the glory of Solomon's reign, ending with a captivity and the patronage of Cyrus the Persian. Its broad divisions are Solomon 1 through 9, this is the second chronicle, the kings of Judah 10 through 36. Solomon's 40-year reign is in 1 through 9. Early establishment. He built the temple and all of his glory. First of all, this book opens with the story of Solomon's entering upon full possession of his kingdom, taking up the great work entrusted to him of building the temple. He commenced by gathering the people with him to a sacred act of worship. God met him in a special vision of the night, as a result of which wisdom was granted to him. The promise was made of great material prosperity. Then followed the days of Israel's greatest glory, as far as material things were concerned. Prosperity is always a more insidious danger than adversity to man. David did really, really well when he was being chased by Saul. How many years did you do this? And we must beware. Amen. Solomon in the temple. Solomon devoted himself to his great work of building the temple. In all fundamental essentials, it was on the pattern of the temple which Moses had made. Okay, the pattern of the tabernacle which Moses had made. His proportions and relations were identical, but it was larger. It was much larger. Okay. The period occupied
and the building was 7 years. The work being completed with Philel, Belial, and godly care. The king carried into the sacred enclosure all that his father had collected and dedicated to the purpose. Thus, nearly half a millennium after the Exodus, the chosen people were found in the land, having a king on the throne, a temple in the midst of the chief city and the center of national life. The only principles of permanence, however, are the only things that are permanent, not the city, but the temple, for what? Faithfulness, purity. Already the elements of decay were at work in the heart of the king and the mother of the people. Temple dedication, the work of construction being completed, there followed a glad and solemn ceremony of dedication by the people and consecration by God. With awe-inspiring dignity, the Ark of God was carried to its resting place. As at the erection of the temple of old, so now in the new temple, God answered the open room as the cloud of glory possessed and filled the sacred place. In the presence of that manifestation, the king pronounced a blessing on the people, which merged into a blessing offered to God. After praise, the king offered his prayer, which was great in its comprehensiveness and in its understanding of the heart of the people. As the ceremony had begun with sacrifice and song, so did the temple. Great work of all his life in the house. God appeared to him and said, he first declared that the work of God was accepted. The prayer offered his third. Then, with the tenderness and faithfulness of the temple of God, he restated for the king the conditions of his saving.